Greetings, merfolks. I'm your host, Danny Washington, and welcome to season two of 21st Century Mermaids. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, and determination with a ton of swagger and style. Guests we feature are actively contributing to the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science, a global initiative that began in 2021 on a mission to create transformative ocean science solutions for sustainable development, connecting people and our ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid. Intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our beautiful big blue planet. So let's begin with your origin story. I know that you were born in Mexico, which is one of my favorite countries in the world. What was your experience like when you began understanding your passion for the ocean? Was it when you were in Mexico as a child, or did it happen later in life?
It's a great question, Danny, because I think our origin story as ocean warriors is very similar for a lot of us who didn't grow up in the ocean. I grew up in the mountains, central Mexico, Mexico City, and areas nearby. And I just had this passion for reading, for books. So I read pirate books. I had this fascination with stories about pirates and their adventures at high sea. But also Jacques Cousteau. They had that TV series in black and white way back when, which was fascinating. And like everybody else, I devoured every issue of National Geographic. So it was not just the ocean. It was just the mysteries of our planet. But the ocean had this special pull for me. And when you are 7, 8 years old and you live up in the mountains and you only go to the beach on holiday, you don't imagine that you're going to be able to make a career out of it, but somehow life takes you there.
I love that. And do you have a specific story that you remember? Maybe one of those first moments that you had a chance to interact with the ocean? And if you could take us there, like tell us the story of that moment, if you can remember what that was like.
It's a funny story. So my father is from or was from a small city in the Gulf of Mexico called Tampico in the state of Tamaulipas, which is where so many of the oil exploration projects are happening in Mexico. So my trips to the beach in Tampico would be with a bucket of gasoline to clean up our oily feet after swimming on the beach because it was awful. Wow. But I distinctly remember my dad telling me, always be very respectful of the ocean. The ocean is very powerful. Never turn your back to the ocean. And that's exactly what I did. You know, I turned my back to walk out of the ocean, and a wave came in and tumbled me, and I swallowed sand and crawled on the bottom, you know, the whole drill. When I came out, I was like, whoa, this is what I want to do. This is awesome.
You know, for most people, that kind of experience would end up being traumatic, right? Never wanting to go back in the ocean again after being tumbled in the waves. I can totally relate that feeling of lack of control where you're letting the ocean take you wherever it's going to take you. It requires so much surrender and this idea of just letting go. And that's actually one of the things that I love the most about the ocean is it forces you to be present. It forces you to let go and surrender.
And be humble.
Yeah, and be humble, always. Like you can never come into the ocean, dive into the ocean ever with a big haughty attitude or being too prideful. Like there's no way. It'll humble you just like that. Now, what about with wildlife? When was that first moment that struck you as like, whoa, like this is something that I know only a handful of people have seen in person? And how did that impact you in the moment?
You know, one of the first experiences I had with marine wildlife was actually in Mexico City. They had that amazing orca, Keiko, living in a swimming pool. And so my mother took me to see the show. And even for a child, I knew that it was so wrong. So that was one of the first times I saw a living wild creature in the ocean. But experiencing wildlife firsthand, I don't even know, Danny, if I imagined it, if it was real. I was in university, so I'm already in my 20s, and I went to study marine biology because I had this dream that there was going to be dolphins and whales. And of course, you spend a lot of time in the lab and learning scientific names and doing math tests and all the other stuff. And it was probably in my third or fourth year of university that I still hadn't seen any wild animals, and certainly not living ones. And we went on a collecting plankton thing once in a little boat, and it was very shaky. I remember getting seasick and lying in the bottom of the boat and then looking up, and I thought I saw a shark, you know. So I left university without really experiencing wild ocean. It was not until much later.
Wow. That's so interesting. A couple of reasons why that's interesting to me is, number one, that's one of the parallels that we have in our life and our career trajectory. We both studied marine biology in undergrad. I worked in the graduate school while I was an undergrad. And so I learned a lot about academia in that time and realized, I don't know if this is for me. That's why I kind of want to move into communications and be able to be a conduit between academia and the rest of the public. But also the second thing that connects me to this story is the fact that you said you got seasick. Fun fact, I do get seasick, but I take medicine for it. And it takes, you know, if it's a day trip, it'll sometimes hit me if the conditions are really harsh. But if I'm on a boat for a period of 3 days or more, my body completely adjusts after that point. But it's one of the unlucky things that I've had experience in my life. People always look at me like, what? You get seasick? I'm like, yeah, I'm not, I wasn't born with sea legs. So do you feel like you were born with sea legs or not really?
Well, the funny part of the story is that's the only time in my life that I've ever been seasick. Oh,
so lucky.
And I don't waste it on anybody. You know, I'm one of those very lucky people that just doesn't get seasick. So I'm always the person taking care of everybody, cooking. I'm the person on watch because I'm not seasick.
So good. Oh, I love it. So I know right now, if we speed up to today and what you're working on, I'd love to hear more about Sea Legacy and how your organization came about with your partner, Paul Nicklin, and, you know, where the idea came from in the first place.
I love that question, Danny. Thank you for asking that. Paul and I both were marine biologists in our first part of our lives. And just like you, you know, the part that I connect to your story is we knew that science is really important and the foundation of everything we do. But connecting the science through the general public requires storytelling. You know, data and graphs are just not enough to make people go, oh, I see how this affects me. So we both became storytellers, and just the tool of choice became a camera. Really, for me, it was an accident. I just happened to pick up one and realized that I could take pictures. It could have been anything else. You know, one of those lucky things, I think it's part courage and just part luck to open the doors that are the opportunities that are given to you and explore avenues that sometimes are scary. So that's how I found myself at National Geographic. We were, you know, doing stories on the magazine and advising on science and getting grants, doing the whole National Geographic thing, and realizing, because we were at the front lines, that our oceans are in real trouble. And it's so invisible and so alien to so many people that how do you create a connection, this feeling that we are ocean creatures because our planet is made of ocean? And at the top of our careers, Danny, we decided that National Geographic, it was eating up too much of our time and we were not being impactful enough. And so we left and we decided to start a nonprofit, and we were very naive. We thought, oh my God, you know, we're National Geographic. People are just going to give us money, and realized very quickly that it's very competitive, very serious thing to start a nonprofit, that convincing your donors of your impact is paramount to succeeding. And we didn't know anything about it. So for a long time, Sea Legacy, it was, yes, of course, about telling stories and about growing the audience on social media. But we started going down all these avenues of, like, we have to prove to our followers that our stories are saving turtles and are saving sharks. Mm. And that can take you down many different rabbit holes, but it's a difficult thing to do. So we have come full circle to say stories really matter. Stories move the needle. Without storytelling, we cannot save the ocean or the Amazon or any, you know, anything else. Storytelling connects us to, you know, the origins of an issue all the way to its resolution. And it changes the perspectives and the mind shifts of people. And you know, I don't feel the necessity, the need to justify storytelling anymore. It's just really important.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, storytelling is everything. And that's what lights up, you know, that part of our brain, our human brain, where we hear someone say, I want to tell you a story. That it's innate and within us. And especially when you combine verbal stories with visuals, that is where the magic happens. And because of you and Paul applying your talents through photography to the storytelling about the ocean, I think that for me has always been it just stood out, because so many organizations are out there working for the ocean every single day, day in and day out, but yet they can't quite nail the storytelling part on the head, right? Like, it needs so much more help. So I've always respected that about Sea Legacy, is that the storytelling is super crisp, super clear, and it's mission oriented, where you can give your audience and your followers an opportunity to get involved. And I think it's just awesome.
Likewise. Mm. You're a good storyteller too.
Thank you. So in 2019, you joined forces with Emmy Award-winning cinematographer Sean Heinrichs and Blue Sphere Foundation, and you all formed something special together. What is that about?
So we knew that when you tell somebody a story, you activate something in that person that compels you to want to do something about it. And we've all been to a documentary where we're presented with a horrific reality of climate change or whatever. And if you're not giving an avenue for action, you leave the theater thinking we're screwed and there's nothing we can do. And it's very defeating. So we came together with Sean to create an activation platform, a place where we could send people to take an action. And actions can be any number of things. They can be signing a petition, they can be, you know, signing a pledge, or they can be adopting a mangrove or a coral reef. And that's how we build Only One. And Only One is become a very, very successful platform on its own right, where people can know that they didn't just sign a petition, they actually moved the needle, because we tell them the story of how it ended. And so, yeah, Sea Legacy continues to be storytelling. Only One is all action and activation for the sector. So any organization can bring an issue for Only One to build actions around.
Mm, awesome. Yeah. And the website's fantastic, because you can pick whichever cause about within ocean conservation that you care about, and you can get involved immediately and connect with creators, people who are storytelling out in the world and doing that. All the campaigns that I've been a part of have been really fun. And
you've been an amazing, amazing spokesperson and ambassador for Only One. Thank you, Dani.
You're very welcome. Very welcome. Right now, I know that Antarctica 2020 is on the forefront of the campaigns within the Only One platform. Where are we right now with that campaign, and how have things progressed?
It's very funny. I just came back from Lisbon, and everybody's talking about Antarctica and how we're going to go forward. In order to create marine protection in Antarctica, we need the consensus of 25 countries, Russia being one of them. And the situation in Ukraine makes it really difficult to have those conversations right now. So everything is a little bit stalled. There are a number of strategies that are being discussed, including moratoriums on fishing, which would be very appropriate, or how do you deal with a country like Russia and international diplomacy, right? So it's not clear, but what is clear is that we at Sea Legacy can continue to share the story of why Antarctica and protecting the Southern Ocean is such an important part of solving the climate change crisis and, you know, maintaining the resilience of our planet. So,
well, I think when people talk about Antarctica, those who are not connected to the ocean community, it's a bit of a long shot, because not many people, number one, have been to Antarctica. Number two, the inspiration to learn more about why Antarctica is important to our planet doesn't seem to hit, you know, a chord with a lot of people that I speak to. How do you go about sharing the story of Antarctica and its role in the health of our planet?
I make it super simple. I just say Antarctica is the air conditioning system for our planet. And people kind of get like, oh, you know, it's like an incredibly oversimplified and incorrect way of thinking.
But sometimes you have to make it that simple.
You know, the importance of your work, Dani, is that the more I share on social media and hear the comments from people, the more I realize just the level of illiteracy that we have on how our planet works and how the ocean works. And it's something that's difficult to resolve, because this has to be something that happens in school. We are all passengers on this great spaceship, and understanding the workings of our spaceship planet would be like paramount importance, but it's not something we're learning in school these days. So people don't know anything about ecology. They don't understand the carbon cycle. It's difficult to talk about the substance of things when the fundamentals are not there.
Yeah. And even more than that, I think it's just about asking questions. Most people are not ready or willing to ask deeper questions about things they don't understand. But that's the thing that excites me the most about science communications, is that the opportunities are endless. Wherever you can find your in to create that conversation and to inspire someone to say, oh, let me think about that a little bit deeper, or let me find out some more information. That's when I know it's working, when folks are inspired to take it to the next level and take the next steps to learn more.
That's the magic of photography. You really lower the price of entry into the conversation, because people are not intimidated to ask a question about a photograph.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, even for me, it's intimidating to ask questions about science when you don't have a full context and you don't speak the language. But photography, you know, makes it easy for people to say, tell me more about what's happening there.
Exactly.
Like you said, that entry point is critical.
Absolutely. Now, going back to photography, your career and trajectory as a photographer has been expansive. Being a photographer, a wildlife photographer, especially a conservation photographer, it takes a lot of grit to do that type of work, because you're in remote places, places that are maybe not welcoming for women all the time, all kinds of different factors. How have you formed your, I guess, the way that you approach your work? What lessons have you learned? Maybe give me the top three things that you've learned as a conservation photographer, and what creates that grit?
You just mentioned something really interesting. Of the two big obstacles in my life, being Latino and being a woman has been by far harder. Mm. So many ways. It's really difficult to be a woman in this line of work. It's very male dominated. The equipment is heavy, it's complex, and it is dangerous for women to travel to some of these places alone. So overcoming that has been, it's kind of like the narrative of our work, right? How do you get around that? At the beginning of my career, I wanted to be a wildlife photographer, but I had little kids. And that's the other thing, you know, you're a mom, and it's still not culturally appropriate for mothers to abandon their children and take off on assignment. So I used to take my kids with me. And I realized very quickly that going around the jungle chasing animals is difficult, but staying in the village is easy when you have children, because everybody wants to help you with the kids.
Wow.
And so pretty soon I was finding myself invited to people's homes and, you know, having meals. Everybody wanted to take care of these kids. And it opened a window into the lives of people that live in remote areas, that live close to nature, close to our planet. And, you know, nobody else was doing that kind of work. So I found a niche there. And then the wildlife part has been almost accidental, because I never had the opportunity to really pursue it. Like, not like a Paul Nicklin or a Bertie Gregory that go out on assignment for months. For me, it was always very opportunistic. And it didn't become an opportunity for me again until I took an underwater camera for the first time. And I made my first split photograph, and I saw the world in a different way. I saw a whole new universe of work there, which I've been pursuing for the last 10 years. And just in the last 2 years, bringing back to people, the people that live on the coast, the story of the edge between the ocean and humanity, but told from the perspective of the sea, somebody that nobody else is doing.
That's great. That's really great. So what other triumphs do you think your photography has allowed you to accomplish? I think, as we said earlier, pictures can speak so much more than just words. And in order to use a powerful photo in its best light, what's something that you've seen from maybe your top three photographs that you've put out in the world? What type of triumph have you seen from that?
I had a eureka moment in my early career, because, like I said, this was a very male-dominated activity, and I was going to all these conferences that were, you know, all these retired doctors, and they had all the latest and the greatest, and all they cared about was, you know, where can you go to shoot polar bears and eagles? And they had like these checklists. And I kept thinking, you know, if only we could use our images to advocate for the places and the species that we photograph, I mean, we could have tremendous impact. But they didn't want to hear about that. I said, you know, I'm just going to create my own organization. And I started the International League of Conservation Photographers. And the whole idea was I followed the work of some photographers who back then were nature photographers, but that really were giving their work a lot more purpose. Somebody like Nick Nichols, you know, he walked 2,000 miles from Cameroon all the way to the coast in Gabon, following the trails of forest elephants.
Wow.
And showing us a world that no human had ever seen. And then he took those images and he used them to advocate for the creation of 13 new national parks. And I thought, well, that's a little more than nature photographer right there.
Uh-huh.
I called it conservation photography. And I wrote a paper defining this, you know, this additional step, this purposeful step, that pushing the trigger is not enough. And I found 100 photographers around the world that were doing that kind of advocacy with their work. And that was the beginning of the ILCP. And so creating and defining a new discipline in photography, I think it was a great contribution. And the fact that there's thousands of photographers today that wear this label and proudly, and they're an army out there telling stories, is, I think, part of my legacy, I hope.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely is a part of your legacy, for sure. And that's the beauty of photography and visuals. You can They live forever so long as we have the technology to view them. So when it comes to advocacy work through your photography, not only do you meet wildlife, but you also meet people, and like the people you mentioned who would help take care of your children when you were out in the field with them. What about the communities themselves that you interact with when you go to these places around the world? What are some of the nuances related to connecting with those communities, and how do you go about building your relationship with those communities?
I think I spoke about being a woman, having what been one of the biggest obstacles in my life. It was also one of the greatest gifts, because spending time with people that live in remote places, you are exposed to a lot of the struggle, the injustice, the inequality of a very colonial planet. And having that empathy for people that I knew would never have a fair shake was one of the cornerstones of my career, and especially women, Danny. I remember thinking way back when we were starting to talk about how we're going to solve problems like climate change, and you look around and you see how disempowered women are around the world, not getting paid the same or not even allowed to work, not allowed to own a bank account or not allowed to own a business or not allowed to do much without your husband's or your father's permission. I mean, all of those handicaps are preventing half of the population of this planet from participating in the solutions. And I could also see that there's a sisterhood around the planet. Women are so empathetic towards each other, and they lift each other. And it's not just in one place or one village. Everywhere you go, women have this ability to build a safety net around them for all those around them. And I have always loved that. And I wanted that to be part of the story that I was telling. I wanted to honor women, and I wanted to honor minorities, you know, and I wanted to battle the narrative of colonization with a new story.
Yeah. And what is that story?
You know, I really lean a lot on the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, because he didn't start his speech by telling us he had a nightmare. He told us what the dream was.
Yes.
And so I do dream of a world where women are playing much more of a leadership role at every level. We don't need to be giving women sewing machines or goats. We don't need to talk about giving them a seat at the table. We need to make a table for women.
Yes. Yes.
Women are able to lead with more empathy and with, you know, this idea that we're looking out for the next 7 generations. Those types of values is what this planet needs.
Ah, that's fantastic. And so funny that you mentioned empathy, because that's a core concept that we talk about in each episode of 21st Century Mermaids. It's this idea of how do we cultivate more empathy for the ocean, but also for each other. I think that's absolutely critical in this journey toward protecting what we have left. And I also like this idea that I read about on your website of enoughness. And I'd love to hear your perspective about that and what that means to you.
It came to me spending time with people that live with very little, and they certainly have a bigger sense of fulfillment than a lot of the people that I was hanging out with at the time. I used to live in a very affluent community just outside of Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. Stepford wives. And there was no amount of stuff that was ever enough, right? They needed to go to the mall, and they needed to get the hair. I remember sitting with women that had almost nothing, But they had a sense of enoughness of, you know, this is all I need. And everything I have is being used and I'm not wasting anything. And I thought that that was really valuable. And it's a value that we can cultivate in ourselves by asking ourselves, how much is enough for me? And it allows you to walk away from a lot of nonsense and a lot of wastefulness. So I practice it routinely. And I mean, even last night, I had to pick up something from online shopping. And I went to the online shop and I thought, what else do I need? And I'm like, I don't really need anything. It's such a great feeling.
It's liberating, right?
It's liberating. And it's good for our planet. And so everybody needs to cultivate whatever is right for them in their own sense of enoughness.
That's beautiful. I love that. I want to have a little fun. I want to talk about your experience with this idea of mermaids. Where did that mythology come into your life? When was your first introduction to it? And do you have any mermaid figures, maybe culturally or something that you read in a book that really resonates with you?
Yeah, mermaids are powerful figures. And I was a little girl, you know, and one of four girls and a boy in my family. So my father always had pirate books for my brother and mermaid books for the girls. And mermaids were very powerful creatures. You know, they live in the ocean and they're capable of seducing the weaknesses of men and taking them into the ocean.
Into the depths.
And I always thought that was pretty badass. But there's something very powerful, Danny, about the enormous community of women scientists around the world doing ocean conservation. And so maybe 15 years ago, I started a manuscript for a book that I called A Mermaid Song to Save the Sea. And it talked about the work of scientists like Amanda Vincent and Jeannie Clark, who studied sharks, and Dr. Sylvia Earle.
Yes.
And, you know, I gathered probably 200 female scientists studying different aspects of the ocean and their teachings and the things that they were saying. To me, they were like a mermaid song. They had that power to pull us all into the ocean. And sadly, I never pursued the book, but maybe one day, right? Because those are stories.
That would be incredible. Yes. It sounds like a book that needs to be out there in the world for sure.
You're one of those mermaids, Danny. Hey.
So. The Mocha Mermaid.
A mermaid, I love.
Oh my goodness. I've always loved the fact that the spirit of a mermaid is really about adventure and defining your own role, your own life. And that's really what has attracted me throughout my life. And even as a 35-year-old now, I still feel attached to it. And I think we need more room to use our imaginations. And why not?
Like, for sure. And to use our voices. I mean, that's the power of a mermaid. If you remember in The Little Mermaid, you know, the big punishment is she's to lose her voice.
Exactly.
And for a boy, no less.
Yeah, not for our modern mermaids. So, you know, how do you take that mermaid spirit when you're doing your work and you walk into those rooms? Like you just said, you were at the Ocean Conference in Lisbon, and I'm sure you've been to countless other events where powerful people are talking about the ocean in one place. How do you embody that mermaid spirit wherever you go?
That's a great question. I so enjoyed this latest UN summit because I think the ocean community had been waiting for a long time to come together and share. And there was just this buzz going around the whole place. Seen so many of our friends, our fellow mermaids and mermen, collectively speaking about the things that matter, right? We're going to reach 30% protection before 2030, Danny. That's a big deal. And people are now talking about enormous conservation opportunities because of blue carbon, which builds blue economies. And people are talking about coming together to stop things like deep sea mining and bottom trawling, because these are industries that are contributing to carbon. And I mean, things that we were never talking about before felt really real. And there were a couple of mermaids in the whole conference. One of them was Dr. Sylvia Earle, who's our mother mermaid.
She's
fantastic. And the other mermaid was Donna Bertarelli. You know, she's a philanthropist and she could have chosen to just write checks and take a step back, but she is inserted into every conversation like an ocean diplomat. She's like a mermaid. I mean, she dresses with these beautiful dresses and commands the attention of the audience with the right messages and the right diplomacy. And I was inspired by that as well. So for myself, I think there's an important aspect to the work that we do, Danny, and that is to maintain a positive attitude and a sense of hope and a sense of purpose. And I see that very much as my role.
That's so cool. Well, 21st Century Mermaids podcast is an official activity of the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development. And we support, you know, of course, like we talked about, the protection of 30% of the oceans, at least by 2030. How else do you think people can contribute to achieving this massive goal?
Yeah, you know, one of the themes that came out of this ocean summit was the idea of rewilding the ocean. And there's actually a new book that just came out about it. And it basically, it means two things. You know, if you leave the ocean alone, it comes back.
Yes.
And we know that.
Yes.
When you protect it, the fish all of a sudden become huge and they start reproducing. And pretty soon, even kelp forests that had disappeared are blooming again. And the second thing is we have to restore the places that have been damaged, all the mangroves, the reefs that have been destroyed. There needs to be a serious investment. And finally, we really need to get a grasp on the ocean pollution aspect of things. You know, I really gravitated to this idea of UN global treaty on plastics.
Yeah, we need people to be on the same page about plastics for sure. I've been thinking about that as well. And I actually have been leaning more toward this idea of what is the waste and disposal industry look like in 20 years? How can we innovate our way out of all the trash we've already created and then closing that loop? And if there are still plastics around that we need to use that are vital for our everyday functioning, how do we keep them out of the ocean? And I find that very exciting because there aren't enough people innovating in that space yet. And it's an opportunity for us to figure it out.
You just painted a picture of the future for us, Nani. That's a superpower.
Well, like you said, it's about envisioning the future. If we don't have a vision of where we want to go, we're never going to get there. It's important that we speak it, we live it, we breathe it. And as leaders in this space, it's important to just continue to amplify those ideas and make people visualize it too.
So one of the highlights for me of this summit was I got to meet Dr. Carlos Duarte, the father of blue carbon. And he co-authored a paper a couple of years ago with 20 of my other favorite scientists. It's called Rebuilding Marine Life in a Single Generation. And those scientists, they gave us a recipe for how we get there. And this envisioning of the future, you know, can you imagine by 2050, Dani, that we have a healthy and abundant ocean, what that means?
That would be incredible. Yeah, it gives me goosebumps just as you say that. Yes.
We can do it.
Yeah, we can innovate our way out of these issues and challenges. We just have to set our minds to do it. And that's what it's going to take.
A whole bunch of mermaids,
a whole pod of mermaids, and we are bringing the pod together. And just want to say thank you, Christina, for all the work that you're doing and how you're leading our mermaid pod in the right direction. Seriously. And I'm just excited for all the things to come. And I definitely hope that we'll get a chance to meet each other in person one day and be in the ocean together somewhere in the world.
That's a beautiful dream, and we will make that happen.
Yes, Dani. Absolutely.
Thank you for everything you do. You're an inspiration, and I really do love seeing you everywhere. And keep doing it for as long as you can.
I definitely will. Thank you so much. Was there anything I didn't ask that you wanted to talk about or anything that you wanted to feature about Sea Legacy?
We're going to be focusing our efforts coming forward on a series of videos that Paul and I call The Sea of Hope. And these are the hopeful stories of how the ocean is changing in a positive way, just to keep us all motivated and inspired, and so that we know that there is a path forward.
Totally. Great. And last thing, what are the best ways to follow your work?
Absolutely. SeaLegacy.org is still the home of the Tide. The Tide is a community of people that donate every month to allow us to tell the stories that are moving the needle. And it's July. Paul Nicklin's birthday is coming up. July 21st is our invitation for everybody to support Sea Legacy through the Tide. And then on Instagram, we try to tell stories every day, little bite-sized nuggets of ocean wisdom that we all need to know about our planet.
Beautiful. Oh my gosh. Yay! All right. Thank you, Mitty. "21st Century Mermaids" is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Dani Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.